Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night, and welcome to a very, very special episode of Endurance Chat. I'm KiwiChris1709, and I've been given the reins for this show for some reason.
Whose idea was this?
I don't know, but I got a feeling that person's a dumb Australian like Flightman 11.
Hey, that's not nice. How you doing?
Hey, good mate, good. And with us again tonight is Sol Holmes. G'day, Sol.
Hello.
Hey.
Hello.
Hi. And now this is a very special episode, not just because I'm hosting, but because we're doing something a bit different today. The Unpopular Opinions Special. Now thank you to all of you who have contributed your ideas over the last month, be it in text, we've got a few audio recordings as well. And what we're going to do is take your ideas, basically discuss them and rant for the next couple of hours. You boys keen for that?
Yeah, I love ranting.
Who doesn't?
Yes, let's go.
Let's do it. All right. Now, the first one, we're going to start off with an audio recording from B.H. Ufter. He's got a great piece here about equivalence of technology. Take a listen.
Everyone's right. The LMP1 equivalence of technology is extremely unfair. Extremely unfair to Toyota, that is. A bunch of rich guys are demanding that their low-tech, inefficient, and sometimes rather unreliable novelty projects meant to sell watches, banking, oil, venture capital, and whatever it is that Bicolis does, be able to compete against an R&D project that's developing improved road car technology. So, they convince the ACO to use the cudgel of equivalence of technology, and the ACO massively buffed the rich guy's novelty projects. But it still wasn't enough, and they whine about the EOT. Never mind that if the EOT that the privateers were given was actually fair, Toyota wouldn't have beaten them by 12 laps. They'd have beaten them by about 100 laps, or maybe more. For that matter, they would have been vastly slower than LMP2 if the EOT were fair. I should be completely clear here. I do not have any problem with the ACO's decision to give the privateers the buffs that they have. The ACO is in the business of selling a racing product. After Porsche pulled out, had they not done this, there would not have been any racing in LMP1. So I get it. Additionally, Toyota asked for this. Toyota wanted competition. And in that respect, should the privateers get buffed even further? Yes. I just have a problem with the attitude that the privateers deserve more. They don't. They're so far behind, ignoring the hybrid technology, they are so far behind Toyota that the equivalence of technology is not fair to Toyota. This has been an unpopular opinion by B.H. Toofer. B-H-T-O-O-E-F-R.
I really should have listened to that so I knew how to pronounce his name. So, who wants to take a swing?
Ooh, pick me.
Okay, Sol, you go first.
Oh. All right. The way he phrased the first bit, which we had in text, seemed to contradict the second bit that he thinks that the privateers should be buffed even more. And in that respect, I do agree that yes, we needed EOT to have any form of racing. But I haven't seen as much whining. Like I might be completely off the grid, but I haven't seen privateers whine that much about EOT. I mean, yes, Toyota is vastly ahead, and that's just the nature of life. You spend more, you get more. I think their budgets are, what, an order of magnitude above what the privateers are doing.
Are you sure that you haven't seen much complaining about EOT? It seems like every single race there is someone, Jensen Button, Matteo Savakian, Neil Gianni, Andre Lotter are saying, we're not competing against Toyota because they're just so much quicker, even with this EOT that we need more help with.
Alright, that's a fair point.
You keep going. Yeah.
The thing I was thinking more about was the thing with the tires. I mean, obviously it's ridiculous that they have to use the same tires which are designed for completely different purposes. One, the tires that are designed to be driven by four wheels rather than two. But then again, yes, I will concede there has indeed been complaining about EOT. But yes, we do need a product, and that's just the nature of life. The attitude, I mean, if you don't fight, you're not going to get anything. I mean, you can't really just stay quiet and expect things to fall your way. You have to fight in every way possible. So I think that the only way to get a fair EOT, if it's even possible, is to whine about EOT until it's right.
Yep. Fair enough.
And what is it they say? If everyone's whining about EOT, then it's clearly okay.
Well, I mean, I've heard of whining about EOT.
But is it really okay?
Look, I honestly actually don't even think that it is possible to get a proper EOT between hybrids and non-hybrids, simply because of the way that they create their speed. I mean, look back to Silverstone. The SMP Racing BR1 Dallara was faster in qualifying than the Porsche 919 of last year. Yet it still finished four laps down. Why? Because it hasn't got a hybrid. Can't pass cars. Can't pass traffic as quickly as the Toyotas. And that's just the reality of the situation. Now, go ahead.
I was going to say, so on track, you really can't EOT them for that exact reason. It's just, it's like trying to get a supercar to compete with a GT3 car.
They
just need to speak totally different.
Now, back to the crux of, how do you say his name again?
BH Tufa. That guy.
BH Tufa. Back to the crux of what he's saying, that the EOT is unfair to Toyota. Yes, it is. I agree. I feel like this is going to keep happening. I'm going to agree with these unpopular opinions and people are going to hate me. No, it is entirely unfair to Toyota. They have invested so much across the 7 years that they've been a part of LMP1, and the return on their investment is now being artificially, I'm going to use that word specifically, artificially reduced because of the requirements for the ACO to sell a racing product. And he's hit on that very well, and that's exactly what's happened. The ACO have tried to build up this racing product between Toyota and the rest of the LMP1 class, and in order to do that, they need to artificially handicap the Toyota and artificially boost the rest of the class. Now, in contrast to that, though, Toyota knew this when they signed up. They, in fact, asked for this. All privateers knew this when they signed up, and then it's the job of the ACO to try and get it towards the same level. Now, has that happened? No, it hasn't. Toyota are basically bitch-slapping the entire field. And my follow-up to that is that I would have preferred... I should have put this as my unpopular opinion. If we want to discuss this afterwards, I'm okay with this. I would have preferred Toyota to have pulled out along with Porsche. I think that by doing LMP1 this year, they have done themselves a massive disservice, and they're not able to show their true pace or their true development of technology. Mm-hmm. And basically every single result that they're getting this year is just going to be looked at on in a year's time and go, oh, well, that wasn't really a season where LMP1 was relevant.
We're seeing that already with their Le Mans victory. People are just going, they've won. Whatever.
Exactly.
Next.
What's the point of winning Le Mans against no competition? To follow on from that, you could argue that Audi did that a bunch, Porsche did that a bunch, some other further manufacturers did that a bunch. But, of course, we all have a recency bias, and the fact that we're looking back to this year's Le Mans and going, Toyota had no competition besides themselves. Yeah. And, yeah. So there you go.
Yeah, so,
I mean...
Go on, sir.
In the same way you could say that, for example, my, like three or four of Michael Schumacher's seven F1 titles were irrelevant because he didn't really have to beat anyone. Well, he did. For one, he had to beat his own teammate. And for two, Ferrari had to build the best car, even though they had the best base to build on continuously. Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's a fair comparison. I don't think that's a fair comparison at all, because even when you look at those seasons, Ferrari had stringent competition from McLaren. Yes, they were the dominant car and the dominant team, but McLaren were always nipping at their heels. I think that's much, much less the fact nowadays in F1, to use an example, maybe not this year, but maybe 2014, 2015, when Mercedes basically only lost when they shot themselves in the foot.
And to an extent, they're still doing that now.
Yeah, that's a good point.
No, Ferrari. Realistically, Mercedes are being given wins by Ferrari shooting themselves in every single foot they've got. But we're going off topic.
Yeah, let's not talk about the WEC feeder series. Come on.
Yeah.
So I would say that the fact that that Toyota has no one else in the same class as them, literally in the same class as them, as well as figuratively, is unfair to Toyota, because they're basically racing no competition, and they like, what's the incentive for them to race hard? They're basically throwing. We saw it at Silverstone. They threw a win away because they were racing imaginary competition, and it's just like, well, if they weren't there, then it would have been a much more interesting race. But they are, so it's like, well, this is the hand that we've been dealt.
Yeah, and now there's a couple of other comments that have come in similar to this line. The first one here is by Josicki100, where he said, the TSO50 is the fastest sports car ever, and it looks like it's going to be like that for a long time in the future, considering the next regulations in 2020. Limiting that car's performance will be an insult to the car that deserves to be a legend. So if there's no way to make the privateers as competitive as Toyota without touching the 050 or the 050, whatever you want to call it, then let Toyota walk away with their wins and titles. Flood, you're kind of agreeing with that, aren't you, Flood?
Well, I mean, yeah, I've already said that I don't think there's any way to make a fair and even equivalence of technology. So Toyota should just win. Like, they don't have any competition. If we were looking at an entertainment product, if we're looking at the ACO's perspective, I would have been thinking more like, hey, Toyota, you should maybe take a break and let the privateers run at it. But the ACO actually had the opposite opinion and were very much trying to keep Toyota in, because at least then there was some manufacturer presence and relevance. So, yeah. At least, just on that first point, the TSO50 is the fastest sports car ever. Well, it's the fastest sports car ever because it's allowed to be the fastest sports car ever. They've built this to the current year's regulations, which are the fastest regulations that we've had, and they're good at it. If Porsche had built their car to this current year's regulation, they probably would have been faster. You could argue that the 919 Evo is the fastest sports car ever because it's a sports car that's built outside of regulations that has been proven to go faster, but yeah, in the end, I actually agree with all of the points that have been raised, except for the fact that Toyota should really have just left.
Yeah, funny you mentioned the 919. 4SG to Yi chimed in on that as well. He said it's just basically a PR move to cash back it on their now closed LMP1 project. Doesn't serve any purpose apart from demonstrating that the cars subjected to no rules are faster than cars subjected to rules. I mean, duh.
Yeah, but to say that it has no purpose is... Where else did you see this, by the way? I want to...
This was in our thread.
It's in the original thread.
Oh, I can't find it.
Look harder.
Hang on, I'll send you a permalink. It's not 4SGT.
Giuseppe still, sorry.
Giuseppe, yep.
I think it is just a PR move, because there's really nothing it can be other than a PR move. But I don't think it serves any purpose apart from demonstrating that cars subjected to rules are faster than cars subjected to rules. I think it serves a purpose of showcasing, this is what we can do with this. This is the limit of this platform. Let's tend towards this as time goes on. And there is a second part of this opinion saying the Porsche show came to LMP1, won a few times, and then retired as soon as they needed to reinvest. I disagree. First, Porsche being a part of the Volkswagen group, we know what happened.
Yes, we very much know what happened
with
there.
Dieselgate, with Volkswagen being fined, I think it was 11 or even 12 figures
mm-hmm.
overall worldwide. And yeah, the tap just ran dry, and the announcement of Porsche leaving LMP1 after just winning Le Mans thrice on the trot was a bit of a shock. Mm-hmm. And my own opinion is that they could have done a bit more with that with the 919 Evo. I mean, they went out, set two track records, one of which was beaten very shortly, and then just sort of retired the car and put it around slowly and demonstrate it. And I don't think that's what that car should have done.
I'm going to be completely honest here. I know I'm a moderator, so I'm not meant to have an opinion, but I do on this. As cool as it was to see them go around the Nordschleife and smash that record and all they're done with it, this car really didn't need to exist and it really probably shouldn't have.
I don't necessarily agree that it probably shouldn't have. In any respect, the LMP1 team itself did not make the decision to leave the sport. So that was a separate thing. So the people who make the decisions on where the investment of the company goes aren't the people who are running the race team. So the company and the race team has a responsibility to keep its employees or to pay its employees or that sort of stuff, right? So, and in that respect, at least they still have a job afterwards. It isn't like Nissan where they kind of said, okay, we're done now, goodbye.
but Nissan were never done because they never started.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. Furthermore, technology demonstrations for the sake of technology demonstrations are worth more than people expect, I think. The fact that you have a sports car, a closed-top sports car, which can compete with in outright pace terms with an F1 car is something that we haven't seen since the Group C days or even beforehand. It's marvelous that you can have a car that's that much heavier and that much less... trying to find the right word here. With more like aerodynamic... issues in terms of like having to move air around the cockpit and chassis that of that size and still have it be competitive with an F1 car in terms of pace. That's pretty cool. And yeah, they had to quote break a lot of regulations to do it, but it does show the fact that if you have the right technology, you can still exceed the limits of what people thought possible. And plus the fact that they did a 5 and a bit minute lap at the Nordschleife. Like, have you seen that onboard video?
Oh, it was
like,
nuts.
It was hyperspeed.
Yeah.
So, the fact that it can be done and we have a demonstration and that sort of spurs ideas and sort of like, oh, how can we do this better? Or how can we make this more efficient? And then that sort of stuff then brings new people into it. And like, if a kid had never seen a sports car before and then got told, hey, there's this car that goes faster than an F1 car around Spa-Francorchamps, and then found out about the 919 Hybrid Evo, and then found out about sports car racing, and then was like, I want to develop stuff that's faster than what has been made, and more technologically relevant than what has been made in the future, and becomes a mechanical engineer. Like, that's the whole reason you do these technology developments, and that's mm-hmm. That's why you do these concepts. So the fact that it exists for marketing and for getting a few lap records, that's cool, yeah. The fact that it's got a technology demonstration, yeah, that's more cool. And the fact that it's transcended the sports car community, it reached out into other further communities, is something that's probably going to excite a lot more people about making these technologies.
Now, you talked about marketing there. Isn't that pretty much what Toyota's doing?
Yeah, well, pretty much, right? Like, yeah. Why else is Toyota competing? They want a Le Mans victory and they want a championship.
So,
like, do you think...
In my mind, you can't separate the two. You can't hate Porsche but love what Toyota's doing or love Toyota, you know, or the other way around.
Yeah, I would 100% agree.
Yeah, I mean, you can really only beat whoever shows up. So, like, I mean, we all rave about the Mazda 787B with the four-rotor engine that won Le Mans in 91, but they didn't really have any true competition that year, did they?
Not
just like
really.
Toyota in 2018. I mean, the gap was obviously less because Toyota won by 12 laps. What was the gap anyway? I'm going to look it up right now.
91, yeah, you've got a good point there. You can only beat who shows up, but I think... there's so many intricacies and issues with this season in LMP1 Hybrid that we could do an entire episode in itself about that. And yeah. I'd rather not.
I'd rather not, but there are a couple more questions that people have put through.
Just to wrap up the 919 Evo, they did use some of their findings from the 919 to build the Pikes Peak Volkswagen, didn't they?
Yes. Yes, they did. And a lot of that development has trickled down onto things like the Mission Eve concept, which is now getting a production run and, you know, that sort of stuff as well. So it's not like it's just marketing.
And the Volkswagen Pikes Peak car went out in real competition and smashed the record by about a minute.
Which is bloody scary when you're going up there.
Oh my god, yeah, Pikes Peak is terrifying.
Yeah. So unless you've got anything else to add on this part of it, got another comment here.
I'll have to correct myself. They didn't smash the record by a minute, they smashed it by about 20 seconds.
Yeah, still not bad. Now, this next comment we had in is from Hava La Too Juicy.
I think he's a Slavic person, or they are a Slavic person. Sounds like it.
So, yeah. I apologize for butchering that. Can I buy a vowel?
Yeah. No vowels.
Okay. His comment, and it sort of goes to the whole championship as a whole at the moment. I miss privateers, small manufacturers, and the general feeling of the early 2000s. I blame the ACO for making endurance racing what it is now, a matter of money, politics, and no more sport. A sucker of ELMS since 2004, this is the first year that I really don't care, as G-Drive, that I still like, is unfairly racing with three pros, and anyway, the new LMP2 is too flavourless to me.
Oh, look, it's
nice
typical.
Side step there. Nice side step.
I don't pronounce English words good.
Yeah, well done.
Thoughts on that, lad? So, Fudge, you can take the floor on this one.
So, two issues we're talking about here. One, the oligotypical LMP2, so having the specific manufacturers that have been licensed to build the LMP2 cars, and two, the whole matter of money, politics, and no sport. Well, I'll address that part first. The reality is that there is so much money in sport now that everywhere, legitimately, literally everywhere, is worried about money and politics in the sport. So you look at soccer or football, you look at cricket, you look at any other motorsport, F1, or any other top-level motorsport, even things like V8 supercars and blank paint, there is a level of politics, a level of money lobbying, and a level of artificialized drama that goes into making those sports happen. And that's just the reality of it. And we see that as well in terms of runaway investments into sport. Like, we use LMP1 as an example. The fact that you can just keep investing money into it to the point where it gets ridiculous is why things start to fall apart at the seams. And that's just the way of the modern world. The fact that we have it's just one of those things that has kind of happened in culture that we don't really know why or how, but it just kind of is. Go ahead.
It's a fact of life, isn't it? It's just like spend more, get more. It's where we are. I mean, you do hit diminishing returns at some point, but yeah, spend more, get more.
Exactly. And so what that means is that you can't really have privateers in the same way that you used to, because they just don't have the power to spend as much unless they have some egotistical maniac at the helm. Studio Cameron. So G-Drive with the three pros, yeah, I agree, that's crap, and that shouldn't really have ever happened. But with LMP2, the new LMP2 rules, I actually think are one of the better things that have happened for the WEC and ACO competition in general.
In saying that, though, it did mean that the groups like BR1 Engineering, like Dome, and like those sort of guys did kind of get shoveled out of it. And I can understand why the ACO did it, because when those rules were drafted, the LMP2 class was in a very dire spot. Like, we had 4 full season WC entries when those new LMP2 regulations were drafted. As far as small manufacturers and privateers, that's kind of been shoehorned to where LMP3 is. Like, you have Norma, you have Adess, you have Perrin, I think, also have an LMP3. So that's where they're trying to redirect where these small manufacturers build their cars and put them towards a different class. Now, you can be mad at that or not, but that's the reality of what the ACO has tried to do. And I actually think building a more entry-level sort of thing would be better for those small manufacturers, because it gives them, you know, a stepping stone into maybe winning one of those LMP2 contracts in the future. Which Riley shouldn't have won anyway, because their car is shit.
No, Janessa as well, they have an LMP3, but it's not much good because no one's really driving it.
Well, there was some Politico mumbo jumbo in the background of that as well.
Yeah, true.
Yeah,
true.
I mean, can I just weigh in this? Like, do you want cost control or do you want manufacturers? Like, what do you want what do you want LMP2, for example, to be? Do you want it to be manufacturer oriented, which is going to explode costs, or do you want it oligotypical and privateer oriented, and with what with mandating an AM and so on? Well, AM in quote marks. Like, you just can't have both. You can either have cost control or you can have manufacturers, and there's really not much wiggle room there.
Exactly.
Manufacturers are going to spend money
because they have the power to. And,
The money, so they can spend the money.
Exactly. So that's why this LMP2 formula, where we do have prescribed manufacturers to build these cars at a certain price point, is actually been a good thing for the growth of the class. And you look at P2 in the WEC, we have 7 entrants this year. Last year we had 10. Look at P2 in the ELMS, we have 16 to 17 entrants in the P2 in the ELMS. You look even towards the Asian Le Mans series, where they have the grandfathered cars plus the new ones. They have a healthy-ish, competitive-ish group.
Look to America, where, hey, P2's the top class. Oh, all our Daytona prototypes, they use P2 chassis, so we just pop some bits on.
Exactly. So the P2 class, as it is at the moment, has been one of the success stories of the recent years of the ACO. Yes, it's a shame that they kind of pushed a few people out of it, but hey, look at the people they pushed out of it. BR1 went up to LMP1, which was exactly the point of the LMP2 regulations the way they were.
Yes. And they've done a fine job up there.
Yes. Yes, they have.
Rebellion as well.
Rebellion, they were kind of in bed with Orica, so that doesn't really surprise me.
And Jeanette. No, let's mention that one.
Yeah, let's skip to the next one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, while we're talking about P1s and IMSA and all that sort of stuff, got another one here from War Eagle something or other, 33X. IMSA needs to not worry about the global P1 regulations and continue to develop the DPI concept. The new hypercars might be cheaper than LMP1, but still way too expensive for IMSA. And if they throw away the double-digit prototype grids just to stay on top of the say level, it's blah, blah, blah.
Well done.
The new hypercars might be cheaper than LMP1, but still way too expensive for IMSA. And if they throw away the double-digit prototype grids just to try and stay on the same level as Le Mans, then it will be a real shame. There were very clearly a limited number of teams wanting to race both at Le Mans and in the States. And I don't think that top class in IMSA will be anything more than it was in the final days of ALMS. If they try to introduce P1/GTP/CARCAR.
You're going to use that now as well, CARCAR?
Why not? If it's good enough for GG, it's good enough for me.
I call it P1TNG, but whatever. I'd just like to point out that this, I believe, was submitted before the class split in IMSA was announced. So,
which in itself is stupid.
Yeah, but in the class, like, after the fact, now that we know that the classes are being split, they want DPI to be, like, tending towards LMP1 privateer levels, and maybe later LMP1 hybrid levels as they introduce their off-the-shelf hybrid system in 2022, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, IMSA has decided that precisely this is what they do not want to do, that they want to go towards LMP1 levels, and that they want their manufacturers to spend money, especially... they want their manufacturers to spend money, which is against the aim of LMP2, which is a privateer-oriented class.
Yep, and that's fair enough.
That's just after the fact. I mean, the opinion was IMSA doesn't need to do this. Well, they have.
they haven't done all of it. So the fact that they've split split DPI and P2 kind of gives DPI a de facto top class moniker in IMSA. But I think what War Eagle made the point about was that they don't need to worry about whatever the ACO is doing and just kind of do their own thing, which they're doing. And I'd be surprised to see whatever DPI becomes at Le Mans in the near future, but maybe not in 5 or 6 years, depending on whatever happens with the ACO. But I think the fact that IMSA are doing their own thing, at least for the moment, is kind of good, because there's so much uncertainty with what's going to happen with the future of P1 and how that's going to be competitive and how that's going to work at Le Mans. And the fact that IMSA has something that kind of preserves their competition for the meantime, I think is good. Ultimately, I would like to see find a top-level prototype, but the thing is, you then have to worry about making it affordable to race in both competitions. And at the moment, with the way the LMP1 was, where it was barely affordable to compete in one competition, it's not really feasible, at least for the time being. Could we potentially see a return back to the 2007-09 sort of realm where you had Audi R8 or R10s competing in the International Le Mans Cup and the American Le Mans Series, and you had customer efforts in those programs as well? I hope we do, but at the moment the technology is advancing so quickly that customer efforts in themselves aren't really viable. And you can't really run two independent programs at that level for very long. So, yeah.
There's only a finite number of people that have enough money to spend to race in top-class sports car racing.
Especially as a privateer where that income's not really going towards anything useful.
Yeah, that income is going back into running the race team, not into research and development.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, manufacturers at least have a return on investment through marketing, at the very least.
Mm. And like technology.
Cadillac can go out and say, hey, look, this Cadillac, in quote mark, ran 808 laps around Daytona in 24 hours.
Yeah.
Went on Sunday, Saturday, on Monday.
And exactly. Now, I was going to question a couple of things here. Do you really think there's an appetite for hybrids in the US?
There'll have to be.
Simple as that. What, sorry?
Appetite for...
There will have to be.
What do you say?
There will have to be. Because otherwise car racing is going to disappear in the US.
Yeah.
And that's not a marketing thing or a technology thing. Cars ruin the environment. That's that thing.
It's not really black and white, I think. I'm not of the opinion that internal combustion is going to go away from car racing within the short or the midterm future. I think even as internal combustion cars are banned from the road, I think we're still going to have internal combustion cars on tracks, internal combustion race cars, because the fact of the matter is the internal combustion engine is a very compact and very beautiful solution to the problem of creating energy.
Mm. And energy density of fossil fuels is actually ridiculously high from a...
At the moment they're an order of magnitude and a half above the best current batteries we have, which is...
Exactly.
So, I don't think internal combustion racing is going to go away that soon. I think it's going to become and stay hybrid, but I don't think it's going away and we're going towards an all-electric future because the amount of fuel that's spent by race cars and the amount of environmental damage that's caused is minuscule towards what the industry is doing and what road cars are doing. So I don't think it's as black and white, and I think that we are going to see a hybrid, but still internal combustion based racing future for the next 30 or 40 years. I hope.
We all hope. And I think half the uncertainty at the moment is because we just don't know what's going to happen come 2020. So once we get that verified, we'll be able to be in a better place to make some calls and some decisions of what's going on.
Exactly right.
Yeah. Now,
yeah, and manufacturers are probably going to stop racing internal combustion cars because they will not be selling internal combustion cars within 30 years.
Well, look at the car, look at the manufacturers that are entering Formula E. Nissan, yeah, Renault, yeah, Mercedes, Jag.
Jaguar already in there. I mean, Jaguar already have a road car, electric road car. They've made one.
Yeah.
Plus
sidebar, they've got a
Citroen, Renault or Nissan now. They all want to invest in electric racing. I mean, currently Formula E is little more than a marketing stunt.
Oh, but... don't agree with that. I really don't agree with that. It's
not sports car racing.
They're opening up the regulations in a very controlled way, which is exactly what you wanted to have in a class that is very technologically based, especially with new technology. Mm. So I think Formula E is actually doing a good job at the moment.
They're doing a lot of things right. A few things wrong, but a lot of things right.
That's plus that's a much better opinion than a much better based opinion than mine because I was completely wrong.
plus they've got a Kiwi racing Mitch Evans. Go Mitch.
Oh god damn it, Kiwi, shut up.
I think what they're doing wrong is that they're not opening battery development up because that's what we need to worry about if we're going to do battery electric cars.
But the battery road development cars is going to cost an absolute shed load. So
that's a fair point.
Yeah, so they're trying to attract the interest beforehand, so that way they kind of have people trapped into doing it. And on top of that, the way that they're requiring you to sell it at a fixed price regardless means that people are going to limit their development because they want to be able to make a return on it in the end anyway.
I was completely wrong.
There you go. Just to finish off that point, in terms of hybrid, well, we're seeing hybrid cars pop up in a lot of US markets at the moment, and they're only going to become more and more widespread as time goes along, because the alternative is just not going to be possible in the long term. And so, yeah, hybrid racing, an off-the-shelf hybrid package must become relevant in the US, and it does produce good racing. I mean, part of the reason why we've loved the WEC for so much is the fact that the hybrid racing has been the best racing that we've seen in years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Contributed to by the fact that the fastest way to drive a hybrid car is very different from the fastest way to drive an internal combustion car. And that produces a new form of racing that turned out to be good.
Yeah, I think that'll do for the LMP1 talk. We'll come back to that at the end of the show, but we've got some other topics to talk about around GT racing, which is everyone's favourite. And we'll start with an opinion that he hasn't recorded an audio for, but Flood, you want to take this one away?
Sure. So I didn't record this because I was lazy and unorganised, but my unpopular opinion is that I think there's just too much top-level GT3 racing at the moment. Now, this can be seen as a good thing. You can basically turn on or come to WEC or come to the Blank Pan subreddits and find something to watch basically every race weekend. Now, that's great, and it's great if I'm having a slow weekend and I'm bored and I just want to watch some racing. But the reason that I struggle with the amount of top-level GT3 racing is that it seems to be that all the same teams and all the same drivers are at the head of the field in all of these same categories. Now, when I watch a regional GT series, be that ADAC GT or
like Italian GT or French GT or even Australian GT, I want to see some different drivers. I want to see amateur teams or less experienced teams or less renowned teams in the competition with the fight to win. But you have guys like Timo Bernhard and Kevin Estre, Dries Van Tor, Frederik Vervisch and Adac GT when they're not racing in Blancpain, Nicky Team racing basically every single Aston Martin on the planet, Darren Turner in the WEC and in British GT. It's the same group of people in all of the events doing all the winning. My opinion is that I would rather see some different names and some more up-and-coming talent in these sort of cars, in these regional GT series, than I want to see Kevin Estre or Nicky Team win by three-quarters of a lap. But that's just my opinion.
Well, let's just think about this for a sec, Flood. So we've got, obviously, Blancpain.
Yep.
We've got IMSA's GTD class.
Yep.
You've got... What else do you class as top level?
I think those would be like the very two top level at the moment. Yeah, and then maybe the GT challenge.
Mm-hmm.
So
which is incorporated into other series, really.
Which is fair enough. And then like events like the Nürburgring 24 Hour and those sort of one-off events. So that would be the top. That would be the top. That would be like the absolute top level. But outside of that, there's like ADAC GT, there's French GT, Italian GT, all the regional GT series, and all that sort of stuff. And even like things like Asian GT or Pirelli World Challenge, for example, I would not class that as top level because it just doesn't really get the same sort of support or interest that other GT series get.
Well, ADAC GT definitely does.
Mm.
You need a top line GT series with the big names in Germany because, hey, that's where the cars are made.
That's a good point. but then Blancpain should be that, I think. Like, there's no reason that Blancpain can't have two or three rounds in Germany. There's no reason why Blancpain can't have a more involved calendar. Blancpain only has 10 events is kind of a bit dumb to me. I feel like they should have, like, at least 12 or 13.
You just want a round on Adelaide.
Not really. Like, it's got nothing to do, with me. Stop it. No, the thing is, as a top level series like Blancpain is, as the European GT series, I think that it should make a bigger effort to get to more tracks and have more events, and then leave the regional series for the regional teams.
Mm-hmm. So teams like your team Lazarus can race in Italy and things like
and Ram Racing in the UK and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I think what doesn't help as well, because you've got Kreventic that race when they race, and there's another, what, 6-7 GT3 races?
Big ones, too. Big ones.
And it just turns into a really saturated calendar because of those extra races as well. I don't necessarily hate the big guns racing around world. Like you have in Australia, you have like people like Calvin Vanderlid come down, Christopher Meese come down to race in the Australian GT. That sort of stuff gets people through the turnstiles. I just don't think you need to put a blanket ban on it, sort of thing.
Not necessarily like a ban. Okay, that's a good point that I didn't consider. It does, of course, make these events more attractive in terms of marketing and sponsorship and also viewership. But I think part of the beauty of having a regional GT championship is that it's way more unpredictable, not only because the teams are less experienced, but the drivers aren't necessarily as good, which means there's more mistakes, there's more, variation with how things go. But yeah, that's just me, and it does become a struggle to try and follow all of these GT series, and to the point where I've said plenty of times I only really follow 5 series, and that's because they're the only ones I can commit to.
But you don't need to follow everything.
That's true.
Sorry, you go.
There's only about 52 weekends in a year.
Yeah, and I can't watch racing every week.
Yeah, because there's real life.
Is there, though? Is there really?
Is this just real life? Is it just fantasy?
Is this just fantasy?
Oh, good, we're bringing a singing over here, too.
But I even think, I remember an article a few years ago by Paul Trusswell talking about this exact same thing. I'll see if I can find it. He made the mention after one of the Creventic races, saying that there's just too much racing. And yeah, I tend to agree with him. If I find it, I will post it in the chat, and I'll post it in this discussion thread after this for this podcast, and it will, yeah, I'll be able to hopefully strike up some discussion about it. But yeah, I just think there's just too much going on.
And when you look at next year's calendar for Creventic, they're starting on the 6th of January.
Yeah.
That's obscene.
Well, I mean, they have that kind of weekend booked out for the Dubai 24 hours. So,
but this is before that. This is the Proto Series racing, where they're going to have GTs on track as well. Yeah. That's just obscene. I mean,
there's just so much going on. And Marshall Pruitt did make a very good point in Week in Sports Cars, where he said that it's never been simpler to buy a car. You just go on Amazon, click a button, you get a car, you go race it.
I mean, yeah.
And, like, it's an expensive sport, and it's still the domain of maybe the 0.1%, but it's simpler to get into. And that might be a cause as to why GT racing, especially because that's very relatable and marketable, has exploded over the past few years.
But I think as well, because, like, I'll take Blank Plane for example, because you've got so many GT series under the Blank Plane umbrella. They've got Blank Plane Series Asia, Blank Plane Europe, they've got GT Sports Club, GT4 European Cup, British GTs under their umbrella as well. They can schedule it so people can do all those series, and because there's so much going on as well, that's probably half the reason it seems like there's so much racing going on, because there is. That point makes sense.
And I guess there's also a responsibility for, like, these are factory drivers as well. It's not necessarily them who get, they just kind of get told where to race. But yeah, that's just my thoughts. And I'm sure Nicky Team wants to spend more time on iRacing than he does actually racing anyway.
He probably makes more money from iRacing than he does driving.
Yeah.
We've talked about how much GT3 racing there is, and I think we're in agreement it's too much, and they need to do something about it. This opinion here. Flood, I want you to read it and then have a crack at it.
All right. Yeah. Let's go.
Okay, here we go. From Steve the Purple Cat. There are too many Porsche 911s in sports car racing. They are mostly dull due to the same look for many years and using up spaces that can be used for a greater variety in cars.
Okay,
no,
I'll get...
No, you're wrong, get out, no.
I'd just like to point out that that as soon as the opinion went out, it was very shortly after that, Flood said, I already love this episode idea, and I already hate this opinion on the subreddit. So, yes, but take it away.
This opinion is the worst opinion out of all of them. Okay, so...
Sorry, Steve.
Okay, yes. There have been many iterations of the Porsche 911 across the years. There have been many iterations of the Porsche 911 in sports cars across the years. But to say that they're using up spaces that could be used for a greater variety in cars is simply untrue. One of the reasons the Porsche 911 has been so competitive and so successful is the fact that it's a platform that has been continually improved upon and continually developed. It is, I think, now the longest running single make car that's ever been in production. And I think if it's not, it's only being beaten by the Volkswagen Beetle, which, hey, fun fact, was designed by the father. Oh, sorry, the grandfather of the person who designed the Porsche 911.
And the Toyota Corolla, I think. I'm not sure.
No, not even close. The Toyota Corolla has had brakes since production. 911 hasn't. Either way, the fact that... sorry, let me start that thought again. If you're saying that there's too little variety because Porsches just dominate everything, look at blank pane. There is a grand total of one Porsche in the entire field for the Sprint Cup, and they don't even always enter. So to say that there's too many Porsches in GT racing is demonstrably wrong.
There's just now, as many Audis.
No, there's more Audis, actually. In GT3, at least. Now, if you look further afield, okay, maybe in GTE at the moment, the Porsche is a very popular car because it has been demonstrated to be very successful with its new format, and it's proven to be a car that is competitive. Again, maybe in the States, you might say, hey, there's a few too many Porsches. And, of course, as well, there is the Porsche Carrera Cup, which is its own contained cup. But, you know, Lamborghini has its own Super Trofeo. Audi has its own RALM, like, its own championship around it. Ferrari has its own challenge series around 488. So, you know, to use the, hey, there's too many Porsches, there needs to be more variety, that's kind of a cop-out. That's just a cop-out. And your opinion that they look dull is wrong. But that's just my opinion.
So, Steve the dead cat...
How many lives did I get through there? Did I get through nine lives?
I think you've gone through 12. So, do you want to kick the cat while he's down?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think variety should be the end-all-be-all of sports car racing. Look at road cars. I mean, every single journalist strays about the Porsche 911, and whatever sports car comes out in the sort of low six-figure bracket is first compared to the Porsche 911, because it's a platform that's worked for 55 years, and that works, and they've worked on it, and it's a good platform. I mean, it's inherently maybe flawed because it's rear-engined, give or take. But
flawed, says the car that's been the most successful race car in the entire history of racing. Flawed.
I mean, the engine's in the wrong spot.
Works, I mean, if something
more
works...
More successful car in the entire history of racing.
Doesn't make it right.
I mean, if it works, don't fix it. Don't break it.
Exactly.
Hey.
And let's be honest here. Porsche's whole sports car program, the way they get young drivers up, the way they build their cars, is second to none. I mean, look at the young drivers that are coming through. Kyle Rowley.
Matt Campbell.
Deinst. You can keep rattling them off. You know, it's just...
Giorgio Arruda.
Bloody, even from Australia, you've got Nick Foster, who's raced in WEC last year. You've got all sorts of guys who just make starting to emerge on the scene. And it's all thanks to the Porsche program.
Porsche.
Who?
Yeah.
Who?
El Bamba.
Oh, yeah. That guy. So I think, Steve, we love you, man, but we don't agree with you here.
Yeah, that's actually an unpopular opinion. I'll give that he fit the bill.
He met the brief beautifully.
Yeah, he nailed the brief.
Speaking of unpopular opinions, we're going to play a bit of audio now from our good mate Trevarvasaurus.
Hi guys, this is my unpopular opinion. Safety cars shouldn't be needed for endurance racing. So many times have safety cars changed the outcome of motorsport events. Now, with the improvement of technology and its implementation in motorsport, we can now move away from its necessity and the luck element that safety cars introduce. Take VLN, for example, where they don't use safety cars, on arguably the most dangerous circuit in the world that's currently raced on. These events use slow zones just like the WEC to increase safety but also maintain gaps that are earned by the teams and drivers. The same can be said for full course yellows. With nested slow zones, you can have the area around the incident slower and safer for marshals. Imagine safety car speeds or even lower here, as it's only for a short distance. During a multi-driver pro-am race, a safety car can introduce an imbalance between driver talent throughout the class. For example, imagine two cars, one with the pro at the start, one with the pro at the end, and both having a driver change mid-race. The first pro earns a gap to the AM on pace. Then the safety car comes out and that gap is eradicated. After the driver change, the second place car has a pro in it and the AM has no gap to work with, a sitting duck to the driver behind with much better talent. A similar comparison can be made with saving tyres or using them early to create the gap. The slow zones help to maintain these gaps earned. Race distance covered by one car should be just as tough as every other car on the grid. Being significantly far behind and given free track position to the car in front is not appropriate for the goal of an endurance race based on going the furthest with what you've been given. It's like taking a shortcut in Mario Kart to catch up. With a safety car, it is possible to cover a race distance at a lower average speed when green, but still win. Now I hear you replying already, but what about people losing out with the timing of the slow zones being deployed and removed? This impact can be lessened by removing the restrictions of a slow zone when the leader reaches the position at which the slow zone was deployed. The top class spends an equal amount of time in this slow zone then, but a slower GT still has a chance of losing out ever here. If it's a full course yellow, then every class is equal in this scenario. Another issue with this method is the time taken waiting for the leader to get round to the right position for the slow zones to be removed. This is less time racing under green versus the current slow zone system, but I believe this would still take less time to go to green than the safety cars, as the field doesn't have to be bunched up and the leader can get to the restart position faster than behind a safety car. Another reason I don't like safety cars is they give a nice window to sell adverts in. More safety cars equals more ad revenue and a sport that is more marketable. A cynical take on this is that a series wants as many safety cars as possible to show ads rather than as few as possible. I hope in future safety cars won't be required for safety. They are needed less and less with the technology of slow zones getting better. It's not the job of the safety car to make racing exciting. If we have to resort to that, then there's a bigger problem to fix.
So there's a fair bit to unpack there. Sol, you want to start?
Yeah, okay, the first question is, well, Flood, you've been marshalling. Do you think safety cars can be completely unnecessary when you've got slow zones?
Not completely unnecessary. There's still situations where you do need a safety car because of large accidents, large amounts of debris, and creating a sort of break in the flow of traffic so that way you can actually get on track and do these things. So I'll say that I don't completely agree, but a lot of Trevor raised a lot of good points there.
He did. The points about him, about TV advertising, that's NASCAR.
I'd rather have safety cars filled with TV adverts than have races filled with TV adverts.
This is true. But at the moment,
for example, in IndyCar, where the two races I remember had red flags, which were the 2017 500 and the 2018 race of Pocono, where Wickens crashed. They both heavily padded the red flags with adverts, as, well, there's not much to do under a red flag. And that way, most of the race actually went without adverts, as far as I can remember.
I think that's a very cynical way. I don't even want to dignify that point with a response, to be honest.
But the way, well, they can broadcast like side by side or that anyway, but I think that's irrelevant to the actual point that was being made anyway.
Yes. Yeah.
Does endurance racing need safety cars? We saw it this year at Le Mans that safety cars can have a massive impact on the race. With the GT field.
Specifically, a minute and a half's impact on the race.
Yeah. But I don't know whether there is a much better alternative when you need a safety car to create a break in traffic. Like we saw this, like you saw last week, Flood, with the Toyota 86s having a demolition derby at Turn 4.
Exactly. Yeah. I was one of the support series for the V8s I was marshalling last weekend had a 7-car incident around the corner from us. And they actually red flagged the race in the end because there was only a very small path through it. So in a situation where you have a significant part of the track blocked or inaccessible due to debris or need significant work, like, for example, say the drain at Le Mans this year, or, you know, something like that, something where you need a concrete break in traffic of like 5 or 6 minutes to be able to do work on track, that is a situation where a safety car is the best solution. Now, remember, we've only been having safety cars for the past 35-ish years in motorsport.
Yeah.
Before that, there was just no safety cars. There was no slow zones or anything. You had cars whizzing past at racing speed while recovery vehicles were on track.
Yeah.
Safety 7.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Perfect example, 1987 Wellington 500. the Benson and Hedges car with Tony Longhurst crashed into the wall hard. He actually hit his head on the concrete wall.
Jesus.
As the pit reporter was going out to speak to him in the car, there were still cars going at racing speed.
That's crazy.
We've moved a long way since then.
Yeah, exactly. I think Trevor Vasaurus does make a good point that we should be using slow zones and full course yellows more and more because they preserve the work or preserve the actual... Yeah, well, purity is a bit of a really... I don't really like saying purity because that implies that, you know, there's certain ways to do things for racing to be pure, but no, racing is definitely. Racing. It preserves the gaps and preserves the actual work done by the competitors and by the teams and the strategies. And I think there are certain series that use safety cars better than others. But there still needs to be a precedent in place for using safety cars when the situation calls for it. And I think at Le Mans this year, when they needed to repair that drain, there was going to be marshals with equipment on the track for an extended period of time. Yes, you could have slow zones, but remember, slow zones are still cars going by at literally like faster than street speeds. Exactly, and I would not be comfortable with heavy equipment working on a drain pipe while cars are whizzing past me faster than they would be on a road.
Exactly. So there's a reason the roadwork speed limit is 40, not 80.
Or even 25 in some cases.
Yeah, yeah.
Where I am. So,
can they even drive a 25?
No, probably not. Just not in these race cars.
So yeah, there's something Trevor Vasaurus. He mentioned there about the Nürburgring. There's two things I'll say to that. One, deploying a safety car there would be completely impractical. Completely.
Because it's 25 kilometres of road.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you need four of them. And where are they going to live?
Exactly.
Secondly, the way they monitor that is absolutely strict as all hell. We've seen people kicked out of the race because they went too fast under code 80.
Exactly. And that's the way it should be. That's exactly right. And yeah, the Nürburgring is a special case because the track's 25Ks.
Yeah.
You can't use the same things for the Nürburgring as you would at, say, Simmons Plains or the Norris Ring or, you know, something like that.
Even Spa.
Spa's the one WEC track where a slow zone would make sense.
Yeah.
Because let's not forget, until a few years ago, they used to have two safety cars there.
Really?
Yeah. Because it's about two-thirds the length of Le Mans, or about half the length of Le Mans.
The second safety car would pull off at... Puhorn? I want to say Puhorn? Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Puhorn's about half an hour, yeah.
Yeah. But the... You go.
Just a point about Spa while we're there. At this year's Spa 24, what the hell was that? I mean, every full course yellow, then safety car for a lap just to bunch them all up.
Yeah, see, that was ridiculous. You're not getting any disagreement from me on that one.
Yep. I agree with that.
But I just don't think banning the safety car is a realistic option for endurance racing.
Realistically, yeah.
Anything else?
Good points, though. I feel like as time goes on, we come up with a better solution. Safety cars are going to be used less and less, which is a good thing, but there's still specific situations where they need to be used.
Let's not forget, slow zones can still cause crashes. We've seen it.
Yes. Seen it a few times, in fact.
By Collis,
yes.
2015?
Yep. At Le Mans, and you know all of these things are happening when something that isn't meant to have happened has happened. All these things are happening when there's been a crash and there needs to be a recovery, or there's debris, or there's bad weather. So there's something that is already adding variables to the event. So the safety car is used to control all of these variables, so that way you can deal with the extra stuff. Slow zones, etc., can be used in a similar way, but in the end, when when something is not meant to be happening, you need to be able to control the things that are happening to be able to clear it up.
Yeah.
And safety cars are very good at that.
Absolutely. And there's one other thing he mentioned there that I want to pick up on, because it sort of flows into the next bit of audio. He talked about luck and how luck can be a factor in things like pit stops and how you manage that luck to, you know, and luck's always been part of motorsport.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this next bit of audio talks about that sort of stuff in the pits as well. And it's from, well, Sol, it's your piece of audio.
I'd just like to point out, before we get to this, this was recorded antiquated equipment, so I have better equipment now.
Right, so crappy audio equipment and not really much substance to it, but here's my somewhat unpopular opinion. I want to see minimum pit stop times and maximum stint lengths and whatnot in all of the... in pretty much all sports car racing, which I've seen happen at the Nürburgring 24 Hours and the 24 Hours of Le Mans, is what happened is that no one really understood the rules. No one really understood how it was supposed to work. Well, the teams probably did, but not as much as we had hoped, since one of the two contending cars for the overall win at Le Mans got a penalty for exceeding the maximum stint length. And at the Nürburgring 24 Hours, they have a minimum pit stop time, which varies depending on the number of laps they've completed, and then depends on where they are in the race. And it all just makes it more complicated, you know? Because when you're watching the race, unless you've got a PDF of the regulations open, or some form of notes, you really don't understand what's going on, and it's harder to keep track of the race. It's harder for the spectators, it's harder for the viewers all around the world, it's harder for the teams to understand, and it throws the race out of balance. You don't know what's going on until the last 2 hours or so, and it sort of goes against the endurance spirit, because say at Le Mans, the GTs had a maximum stint length of 14 laps no matter what, and Radio Le Mans, despite all the flack we've given them recently, did make a good point. Why shouldn't you try to save fuel, extend your stint, and profit from that? Because that is the endurance spirit, isn't it? Just go as far as you can in 24 hours. And same with the 24 hours of Nürburgring. Why shouldn't you plan your stints accordingly? Because once you start doing 9-lap stints, for example, you are pretty much locked into 9-lap stints, because the minimum pit stop time after a 9-lap stint always allows you to fuel for 9 laps. Why shouldn't you combine them? That said, I am still in favour of some form of VOP, because the variances of cars are rather great, and without VOP, we would have no race. I'm in favour of reinstating the rule that refueling and tyres cannot be changed at the same time.
So, Flood, you were the only one that probably heard that, probably because of your dodgy internet.
My bad.
Do you want to take your first crack at it then?
So, from what I got from that, you're saying pit stop time shouldn't be a thing, pit stop stint length shouldn't be a thing, BOP should kind of be a thing. Is that sort of the general idea?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I agree with the fact that prescribed stint lengths and prescribed pit stop times are dumb. Especially in professional racing. But in amateur racing, for example, the LMP3 class in the ELMS, you have two pit stops at least. Sorry, you have one pit stop that you can do in as quickly as you can, and the rest must be outside of a minimum time. And then also at the Nürburgring, the Nordschleife, an example that you used, that is in order to be a better equivalence of refueling and tank size, because a very small difference in tank size at the Nürburgring can cause a very massive penalty in terms of pit stop time over the course of a 24-hour race.
So those sort of things I agree with, but in general, I agree with you as well that prescribed stint lengths and prescribed pit stop times shouldn't really be a thing. As I said, though, there's always a shade of black and white in these things.
Yeah. I think there's the way that the two big series this year, in terms of two big European series, WEC and Blancpain, have gone about their pit rules this year, are asinine. Absolutely asinine. I mean,
pretty much.
They had a mandatory brake job as well.
I don't mind that part of it so much. That 5 minute technical stop is a great performance leveler because you can do your brakes in what, a minute?
Yeah, nowadays you can.
But, I think it's 48 seconds.
Yeah, so it gives you time just to tidy up, polish your windscreen, polish your headlights, you know, clean up your tyres.
Yeah, this sort of crosses into safety.
Exactly.
If there weren't a mandatory brake job, they just would have... Some teams would try to run the whole race on one set of brakes, and that wouldn't go very well.
Yeah, and with WEC, if you're going to have minimum stick lengths, you've got to give the... Well, maximum stick lengths. You've got to give the teams room to play in their pit stop, to have strategy to play out. Otherwise, it's literally just a race of who... You know, of just going around in a big circle, big loop of time, and whoever happens to be at the right place at the right time wins. There's no room for strategy at all.
Yeah, pretty much. And that was one of the biggest talking points from Le Mans this year, was the fact that the strategy, especially in GT classes, was basically non-existent.
That quote from last year's race at Spa, where you read out that the pit crew guy was basically like, oh, we're irrelevant now.
Yeah.
You know this?
Yeah.
You don't want people to say that they're irrelevant. Pit crews have always been one of the more important parts of a team's operation, especially in endurance races. How quickly they can get a car in, how quickly they can get it out, how quickly they can change a gearbox in 5 minutes. You know?
As well as one of the more accessible for the common man. I mean, how many people are engineers? How many people are racing? How many people can be mechanics?
Exactly.
Yep. Pretty much.
Pretty much.
That ties... just to round back to the last example that you used about the Nordschleifer, I made mention of this already, but to use some numbers for that, let's say a car... I think one of the cars a few years ago, the McLaren MP412C, was one of the first cars that ran into this. They could do 7.9 laps on a tank. So they would not be able to get around for an 8-lap stint without help from slow zones or that sort of stuff. So you do 7.9 laps in a tank. The Audi from that year could do 8.1 laps in a tank. So had that been allowed to play out over the course of 24 hours, that would have meant that the McLaren would have done at least 3 or 4 more stops, I think, over the course of 24 hours. Now, 3 or 4 more stops in an endurance race is minutes. Minutes, mm-hmm. minutes, and minutes. Exactly. And even at the Nordschleifer, that would be...
That's half a lap.
Half a lap to, even more. So that's why they have that regulation. They have a minimum pit stop time dependent on how many laps you do in a stint. It's to sort of equalize those little points where a small difference can make a large difference. Now, Nürburgring is a special case. At Le Mans, it's you have a similar sort of penalty, but it's not nearly as prevalent. And it's sort of something that you just have to deal with. And at shorter tracks, it's almost non-existent. So, yeah, that's one of the reasons why they have minimum stint lengths. That's I just wanted to clear that up.
However, could there be possibly a better way to institute that sort of equalizer? For example, with a restrictor in the fuel rig, or a different tank size, or a different allowance in the tank size, or something like that.
Doesn't that already happen?
With BOP?
It should, but you can't necessarily get it perfect every single time. Mm. And I would hate to turn up as a racetrack, as a professional GT team, and find that I can 7.9 laps on tank, and my competitors can do 8, and I'm basically losing 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes before the race even starts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was just easier to have that regulation in place as just the safety net. And it's been part of the Nürburgring 24 identity for years and years and years now. So everyone, as I said, everyone knows what they're getting in and everyone's prepared for it.
Yeah.
All right.
And we're done with that. Well, I've got... there's one more big GT item that I want to bring up because I know, Flood, you're keen to have a crack at this one.
I love this. I love this one.
From Grim Brother 1, Ford did nothing wrong. I love seeing the GTs pan around Le Mans and every other circuit and see absolutely no issue with any tactic or practice they've employed in their quest to win. If anything, their program has almost feels more in the spirit of the sport, harking back to the many famous and now revered unfair advantage by many of the sport's most hallowed heroes. A recent rekindled obsession with watching any documentary possible on 50s to 70s sports car racing has only further solidified the SnowMix required soapbox. That last bit is kind of... ooh. Yeah. Flood. Crack.
Okay. So, the Ford GT in itself is probably one of the best GT cars that has ever been made. And they definitely developed it as a sports car for racing before a sports car for the road first, which, you know, that part of it is fine. The fact that they developed it to the letter of the regulations to be as fast as it possibly can is fine. Now, they didn't do anything wrong with that. What they did do wrong, and this is less about the car and more about the team, is that they tried to pretend that everything that they were doing was above board. They tried to pretend that they weren't sandbagging for a better balanced performance come Le Mans. They were trying to pretend that their competitors had an advantage over the car that they didn't have. And when it came to the race itself, and we all saw that they were lying out their asses, but they were still going, oh no, this is unexpected for us. We never thought this was going to happen. It's like, no, you know exactly what you were doing.
Yeah.
And on top of that, the way that they lobbied to penalize the Rizzi Competizione car for an issue that they had themselves as well and didn't get penalized for was less about the car and the competition and more about their disrespect for the other competitors. And on top of that, the fans and the viewers. So that was what they did wrong. And let's not even bring into the fact that they got a waiver to compete in their 50th anniversary year. And they actually still, to this day, haven't completed the deliveries of the required minimum amount of cars in order to get to be homologated for GTE competition. Which is also something that they've done wrong. But in saying that, I do respect the program. I do respect the team and the car and the engineers because they did something phenomenal with that car. And, the results speak for themselves. It's just the way they went about it was a bit like, really? Really? Really?
Do you really need to be unsufferable C-bombs about it?
Exactly. Basically.
Yeah. It's just... Yeah. Sol, do you agree or no?
I don't have much to add other than... I wasn't really that much into sports car racing. In 2016, it was, yeah?
Yeah.
Developing a car as a race car and then roadifying it is what manufacturers have been doing to get away, get out of road car, in quote marks, regulations for decades, building humiliation specials. But yeah, I mean, it's just about. Sorry again. I'm getting tired.
You're getting tired. It's this morning.
It's do unto others as you would have them do to you.
Yeah, the way that they dicked around with Rizzi Competizione and other manufacturers in terms of complaining about balanced performance and everything. Like, they still were complaining about balanced performance this year. And then if you look at their friggin' tire, like, plot their lap speed across the friggin' stint, they had the best lap times and the most consistent lap times. It's just like, no, you don't have any balanced performance disadvantage. You're just insufferable.
Mm.
Just all of you are insufferable. I mean, the car's fantastic, though, and they're a very well-drawn team, and they do deserve the good results that they get, but they're just insufferable.
Yeah. Yeah. Just a wee bit. It was interesting that one of the members, Ross Riders 1, actually commented in response to his to Grimm's thing, saying that Ford entered a category that was meant to be under BAP rules, but the FIA / ACO were likely aware of what Ford were doing, but were caught between a rock and a hard place. If Ford were more penalised than they were, they may threaten to leave, and that would obviously be a bad look for them. Them, I assume, is ACO.
Yeah, and this comes back to what I said at one of the opinions at the very beginning, where no matter what nowadays, sport is driven by profits and marketing and by politics, and this is where, like, and you can't stop it. And of course, having a healthy GT class with many different manufacturers looks good for the ACO and the WEC, looks good from a competitive standpoint, and makes it more attractive to other manufacturers. You had someone like Ford come in, try to get things done their way, get screwed around, and then leave, just up and leave, it would not have reflected well on the ACO. And to use an example that a more general motorsport example, that's why Ferrari can get away with being pricks towards the FIA year on year on year in F1. It's because it would look worse for F1 for Ferrari to leave the sport that they've been a part of since the 50s than it would be for Ferrari to have to leave F1.
Yeah.
I disagree about the Ferrari bit. I think that Ferrari's bluff needs to be called, and they need to be stopped in being pricks towards the FIA. And as for Ford, I mean, again, do unto others, yada, yada, yada. Mm. If what Ford's doing is okay, what's stopping everyone else from doing it? And do we want the sport to look like that?
No, we don't. Politics.
There's enough politics in the sport. We don't need it in motorsport too.
Exactly.
Like, it's just a question of keeping it a sport rather than something else. Even though a very, very, very expensive one.
Indeed. Well, we're almost at the end of this. We've got a few points left. We'll play the last bit of audio we have from Mr. Bufter again.
The proposed 2020 plug-in hybrid LMP1 regulations were a step in the right direction, and the ACO was wrong to have backed away from them in the wake of Porsche's exit. Several nations have proposed bans on sales of new cars without a plug by 2030, and I believe a couple of those even intend to ban sales of all new internal combustion-powered vehicles. Therefore, manufacturers need to have a full line of plug-in hybrids and battery electric vehicles by 2030. They need to be affordable without subsidy, either by governments or manufacturers. They need to be produced in volume, and they need to be desirable to customers. So-called compliance cars that are unprofitable to build and are compromised designs meant to meet California's zero emissions vehicle mandates for the lowest effort possible are not a solution. This requires significant research and development, infrastructure deployment, manufacturing resources such as battery factories, and marketing work. And the rule of thumb is that it takes an automotive manufacturer about 4 to 6 years to design a new generation of car, and new technologies sometimes need a couple generations to get up to speed. This means that the automaker's survival depends on electrifying everything now. The 2020 regulations were a hell of a start on that. They required that fast charging technology be developed, and that the electric system have significant power, energy, and high efficiency to handle the mandated zero emissions modes. This is all stuff that the automakers have to get right in the real world. Instead, the ACO backpedaled to a rule set that allows less technical advancement, I'd argue, than even the original 2009 through 2013 hybrid regulations, with direct limitations on aerodynamic and powertrain efficiency. And the 2024 regulations will apparently focus on hydrogen, which is just the fossil fuel industry's attempt to misdirect clean transportation development for their gain.
Yeah, he mentioned there about all the places that are banning combustion engines. We've got the UK 2040, China 2018 for some cars, France 2040, Germany 2030, India, Ireland, Israel, Netherlands 2030, Taiwan 2040.
Which I all think are very unrealistic timeframes, and they're going to fall flat on the face and it's going to be a disaster, but okay. Anyway.
So,
yeah.
The thing is, like, were they wrong to back away from those regulations? I don't think they were, because they lost their manufacturer. You know, they had one left who was probably going to pull out.
Yeah, I think the initial part of that, that the 2020 plug-in hybrid regulations were a step in the right direction. They were, but maybe not the... Maybe it was too big a step in the right direction. Maybe it needed to be a smaller step. But with the complete void of manufacturer interest after Porsche pulled out, they needed to do something to preserve the competition. And that's why they kind of shirked away from doing something like that. There is a good point in there that research and development is best driven by competition. And this is a point that I've used previously for uni, actually. I had to do an assignment where we were talking, looking at certain... It was for an inorganic chemistry course, and I chose to look at material science and going, well, let's look at the use of materials in motorsport. And what I said at the beginning of that was, if you want to develop something, develop it in the heat of competition, because then you'll be developing at the fastest for the best result. Because that's where if you're driven to win something against another group or another team, you're going to do better, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. It's just like a bit of nature.
Exactly, because humans are competitive.
Yeah, but for that to happen, you need to have competition to start with.
Exactly, you need people to compete against, and so when you don't have that, then there's not going to be any drive to develop. And I mean, look at Toyota this year. Yeah, they developed their car from last year, but they did so mostly at the end of last year when they were still fighting Porsche. They actually used this year's homologated bodywork as an upgrade for last year's series, if that makes sense.
Hmm.
So they basically, in lieu of upgrading the bodywork this year, upgraded the bodywork again last year.
Yeah.
So in terms of, yes, these things requiring significant R&D, they do, which is why the ACO have stepped back from that, because there's no one to compete against. There's no one to push the development forward. So if it was just Toyota, they would be doing it at their own rate, so they wouldn't have anyone to compete against. What they need first is the manufacturer interest to bring... No, they need the manufacturers to be interested in developing that technology to create the regulations to push the development of that technology, to increase the development rate of that technology. That's why the hybrid era was so successful, because you already had manufacturers interested and investing into developing hybrids, who then went, hey, here is a way that we can showcase and develop our technology at a faster rate on the world stage. Let's do that. And then it all blew out of proportion and died, which is what happened. So they need people to be interested in meeting those targets before they can devise a rule set to develop those targets.
And I think we've seen that with the strategy meetings they've had now, that you've seen manufacturers who aren't involved in the series currently come along and say, give their input and say, hey, if you do this, we might be keen.
Like the BMW hydrogen drive sort of stuff.
Mm. And of course, now we're seeing the hydrogen project being announced in the last couple of days.
Exactly. So that's a direction that the ACO can develop their alternative fuels regulations around.
Yeah.
But you need the interest before you can start developing your rule set. And that's the thing that this 2020 regulations didn't really have, these plug-in hybrids. There isn't really the interest in developing these cars away from ICE in that manner yet. They need manufacturers to be interested in displaying that and developing that before they can really devise a rule set that allows that.
And to be honest, manufacturers aren't going to compete unless they have a marketable platform that they can then say, hey, we beat these guys at Le Mans over 24 hours. Like, if there's no interest, again, there's no marketing, and then there's even less interest. It's a complete feedback loop. And that's why the 2020/21, the car, P1, TNG, whatever, what do you want to call it, is a step in the right direction, because it may not be a better platform for R&D, but it can definitely be a more marketable platform, which which draws in more manufacturer interest, because at the end of the day, their biggest financial gain, and they're in this to make money, is through marketing. So, yeah. If it's not marketable, it's not good, by definition.
Maybe not good for the series and good for the competitors, but might produce good good racing. I mean, you can't really call the Turin 86 good marketing, but it produces some good racing.
Doesn't it just?
Mm,
and Ssangyong Utes in New Zealand.
We just... Yeah. Completely off topic, we need the Ssangyong Utes in Australia instead of our Super Utes.
Oh, we do. We do.
Yeah.
It'd be nuts. You'll see them in a couple of weeks' time in NZ.
Yeah.
For a preview on that, make sure to check our Supercar chat.
Nice plug. I like that. Nice plug.
So I think we're drawing to an end here. We've got a few opinions left, a bit more lighthearted, hopefully, or a bit quicker. First one from 4S GTE. WEC should introduce shorter races like IMSA does, but no shorter than 2-2.5 hours. Introduce a few standalone GTE and LMP races, preferably together with European, IMSA, or Asian Le Mans series. Make the 6-hour races stand out more and should be renamed to WSC. No.
Yes and no. Oh, what? You're going to say no?
I'm going to say no to a few of those.
Okay, I'm going to say yes and no.
All right, you tell me what you're saying yes to and I'll tell you why you're wrong.
I'm going to say that we should have shorter races. We should try to... I think that if we had a kind of like a blank pain, a, you know, 5 or 6 round sprint sort of series and a 4 or 5 round endurance series headlined by Le Mans, I reckon that would be a good sports car or IMSA. Oh, no, just with Le Mans. Screw IMSA. We should be more towards like a world sports car thing than just a world endurance thing, because endurance racing, yes, it's fantastic, but it does have a lot of associated costs, so all of your consumables and your reliability sort of things are just going to go through the roof, whereas with shorter races you kind of are able to reduce the monetary requirements for the consumables like fuel and tires, etc., which means that you can compete maybe at a higher level, or maybe have a more varied competition, or just have more rounds. And I mean, I just love watching sports cars, so more rounds.
Yeah, I
personally think 4 hours is short enough.
Okay,
it's because any shorter than that you start to lose that endurance aspect of it.
Well, we are espousing renaming it the World Sports Car Championship.
Yeah, so it doesn't have to maintain an endurance aspect.
But the World Sports Car Championship's always had an endurance aspect, has it not? Cookie, we need you!
I mean,
in some aspects it has, but there's also sprint races at Brands Hatch, for example. Races, I think they even had WSC at the Norris Ring. And didn't
What?
Didn't they have a... WSC race at Sandown?
Yeah, they extended the track slightly.
Yeah, it was awesome.
And in Helsinki, if I recall correctly.
Helsinki?
The FIA GT.
Helsinki.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a 200 miles race of Nürburgring.
Huh.
And 200 miles is not an endurance race.
No, not at all.
That's like 320 Ks.
Which is about 320 laps of that place.
Yeah, you're right.
People would have lost count. But the standalone races, I think we're all in agreement there. No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
No.
No.
I think it makes it more complicated for the newcomer. It splits the series in a way we don't want, but don't necessarily want. It makes the prototype only races, which 4S is espousing. Let's face it, the best racing is in GTE, and
maybe currently
P2's
currently.
But I'd say part of the reason that the WC has grown such a fan base for the past 5 years is the fact that LMP1 class has been, oh yes, let me get some of that.
Yeah,
good point.
And the most attractive aspect of sports car endurance racing is watching cars nearly have crashes in traffic and not have crashes because they're just that damn good.
Yeah, pretty much.
You lose that when you have a standalone race.
Doubleheaders with ELMS, IMSA, or Asia Le Mans Series.
I think there's scope to be smarter about it. Like, you got, when you go to Silverstone, you have the ELMS as a support age. Do that with Fuji in China with the Asia Le Mans Series. We're doing it with Sebring. You know, yep. Do it with those. Hell, come to Australia and do it with the LMP3 Cup.
Or V8.
No, that would never work.
That would never happen. Yeah. I mean,
that actually would never work.
I mean, it'd be amazing, but it'd never happen.
Yeah. I actually think there is scope to look into that more once we get a bit more financial stability within the World Endurance Championship.
Yeah.
I think maybe 11 event, 6 sprint, 5 endurance, with a bit more of an emphasis on those 6 and 12 and 24 hour events would be a very attractive sports car championship to witness and to develop for. I think that should be a goal, but maybe not GTE and LMP standalone races, maybe not combining it with ELMS IMSA Asian Le Mans Series, like having them on the track at the same time, because that would be ridiculous. But certainly to broaden the scope of the series beyond endurance and broaden the scope of the series beyond those rounds that we have that may not be as popular.
Agreed. So we've got another one here from, we're talking about GT racing there, from Zabzi. GT3 are already running sub-4-minute times at Le Mans in low-intensity series. I could see a stronger, more experienced GT3 team matching pace to the current GTE. I think it's time for a GTE-GT3 merger coming soon. This has been on the table for so long and been pulled off the table that many times, and I just don't see it as a realistic option at the moment.
GT3 to Le Mans is the second most unpopular opinion, probably, after DPI to Le Mans.
The thing is, GT3 has become so different to what it was when the merger was originally going to happen.
Mm.
GT3 has become the new, like, sort of pseudo-accessible amateur factory sort of thing, which has meant that the variety has exploded, the amount of manufacturer and development interest has exploded, which means it can't really get shoehorned back into what GTE is, which is more of a sort of GT2. It was the successor of GT2. It was really about building these cars specifically to be a high-level GT event that would take place at Le Mans and would mm-hmm. be the top GT class at Le Mans. Now, I don't think GT3 can do that because it dilutes too much of what makes GTE at Le Mans prestigious.
Yeah, and let's not forget, GT3, you have all sorts of driver rides which you don't have in GTE.
Yeah, and there's...
Designed for amateur drivers.
Exactly, whereas the GTEs are less designed for amateur drivers. In fact, I'd argue that they're not designed for amateur...
They're not.
Amateur drivers have to drive them anyway.
GT3 cars.
GTE.
Oh, yeah, at Le Mans in the Pro class, there was only one gold driver. Everyone else is platinum.
Was that Sven Müller?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's just a car that amateurs hold on for dear life as they try not to go backwards into the Porsche curves.
Exactly. Whereas GT3 has so many series, so many sort of so many participants around the world that to try and shoehorn that into GTE now is probably unfeasible.
Mm.
The fact that they're quick doesn't mean that they necessarily should be the same. Like, yeah, it's difficult to explain the thoughts going on in my head, but just because they're able to do comparable lap times doesn't necessarily mean that they should be merged into GTE and should be competing at Le Mans.
It's like GT500 and V8 supercars, you know, or GT300 supercars. You can't compare those two series, even though they do similar lap times. But they would do similar lap times.
Meh?
No, yes.
Another thing, if GT and GT3 were merged, GT3 costs may explode, and that might price GT3 out of many competitors.
And they've already exploded like a 18-year-old at a...
No, dude, don't even finish that sentence.
I was going to say at a party.
That's actually an extremely good point. You would basically price out so many amateur teams and competitions because GTE or GT3E, whatever, would no longer be, would just become so, it's so much more expensive. And GTE programs are already way more expensive than a comparable GT3 program. And I would hate to see regional GT3 series get shelved because there's no entrance, because no one can afford a GT3E car anymore.
Going back to what you were saying earlier about the regional series should be for the regional drivers.
Exactly. That may result in GT4 becoming more of a thing, which could potentially become a good replacement for that amateur team, amateur driver sort of level of racing.
Which we're already seeing, they're getting the manufacturer support now as well. Arguably too much of it.
Hmm.
Because politics and marketing and business and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
This is real hard.
Yes.
Can I just sit and watch racing without trying to understand the politics behind it?
Yeah, you're the one that started this show.
I am.
Speaking of which, we're a couple left. This one from... Yeah, I don't think this is so much controversial, but it's just good to discuss it. From Satinsic 2. I really like Fernando Alonso going to LMP1 and driving very well, like he did at Le Mans at night. There is a lot of controversy around him and how all the lights were on him just because he's an F1 star, but he showed he is a phenomenal driver, and that his skill translates to endurance too. I really hope that he wins the 500 and gets a well-deserved triple crown. He is one of the best drivers of all time, in my opinion. Do we disagree?
No, we really. Don't disagree. I agree very much. What Fernando Alonso is doing and seemingly intends to do more is some of the best ambassadorial work that has been done for motorsport in decades. And I wish there were more like him. Like 2 years ago, I didn't care about IndyCar a lot. Now it's probably my favorite open wheel series precisely because Fernando Alonso decided to do the 500. And I find out there's this IndyCar thing that's amazing to watch. Who knew? What he's doing, he is exposing more forms of motorsport to each other, and instead of just blind trash talk, those that didn't know that this was a cool thing to watch may now start watching, and now motorsport has now more series have more fans, and those who decide not to watch can at least have a good argument instead of blind trash talk.
I want to address the part about the controversy surrounding him, because I know I was a bit peeved by this coverage that he was getting, but that's not because he's a terrible driver. It's because, and I understand it from the journalist's point of view, because they've got to appeal to the lowest common denominator, which is people who probably don't have a clue what the hell they're watching at Le Mans. So you've got to relate that back to someone they will recognise. But considering that endurance racing is a team sport and it's all about the team and the team successes and the team drives well, I always found that a little grating. I can understand it, but I found it really grating.
That wasn't his fault, though.
No, it definitely wasn't his fault.
He could do literally nothing about it. Every single... he was thrust into the spotlight unwillingly. He always tried to redirect it towards the rest of his team. Like, look at the pole position that that car got at Le Mans. He was so adamant about making sure that Kazuki Nakajima got his moment in the spotlight for doing that lap. And he was, you know, people were trying to get him to stand in the middle of photos. He's no pointing at this guy. This guy was the one who did it. He could really do nothing to quell the massive media storm surrounding him. And that wasn't his fault. That's the modern media's fault. But I was actually surprised at how well he did. I thought he would have struggled a little bit, but damn, he was just phenomenal. Phenomenal.
He was. He's going to be good to watch now that he doesn't have to worry about driving a pesky F1 car around.
GT2 engine.
Yeah. Unless you got anything else to add, Sol, we've got one more opinion to come.
Yeah, but sure, Alonso is toxic and he has burnt every bridge that has come his way. Sure. I mean, yeah.
Hot take.
Sure.
No, that's the common take that Alonso is toxic and he has burnt every bridge. I'm sort of surprised by his humility, for example. Like, we've seen the clip that after Nakajima took the checkered flag at Le Mans, he went on the radio and shouted, "Kaz, you're the man! You are the man!" Like,
yeah.
I mean, he's sort of made himself a part of the team, and I think he's doing good work and he's doing the best with his equipment.
Mm, agreed.
He's just a damn good racing driver.
Yeah, he's okay. No, yeah, he is literally one of the best going around at the moment. The only open-wheel driver better than him at the moment outside of F1 would be Scott Dixon, in my opinion, but that's just me.
He's up there, yeah.
Yeah.
If I knew what the Kiwi national anthem was, I would have started singing it ironically, but I just don't even know.
I think it's a good note to end this very special episode. I actually enjoyed that.
It was good. It was good fun. I love that we talked ourselves into them and then struggled to get ourselves out of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also struggled to speak at some points.
And struggled to transmit, and yeah.
Yeah. So basically just me on a normal Tuesday.
Pretty much.
Yeah. So thank you, Sol. Thank you, Flood, for joining us on this amazing show.
Thank you very much for hosting this and coming up with this idea.
Not a problem.
Thank you.
We may need to do another one of these. I actually enjoyed it. Hopefully we can get more of you guys to actually record, because that would be really cool.
Yeah, yeah. And thank you to the people who recorded and sent stuff in. It was really appreciate it.
Yeah, yeah. So our next Endurance Chat episode will be in a couple of weeks, most likely.
Probably 2 weeks. Yep. Before the Fuji Petite doubleheader.
Yep. It'll be returned to your regularly scheduled non-moronic host.
I very much like how you phrase that.
Until next time, that's Floodman 11, that's Sol Himes, I'm KiwiChris 1709, signing off. Have a good one.
Thank you.
Anti-Gazoo.
would Anti-Gazoo Uzak?
It's more like
Aston Martin.
I don't get it.
Ocean. Okay, so this has been a thing. All right.